It is December 19th, and we are in Yecheskel in Perek Yud Gimel, the 13th chapter, and we are up to Pasuk Yud Zion, verse 17. And we'll finish the Perek today, tonight, it's Hashem. Before we do that, I told you last time that I wanted to try to find a common thread in this theme of three that we had in the first half of this parak. In the first half of the parak dealt with the Nevi'ei HaSheker, the false prophets. And we talked about how they were doing three things wrong. They were not taking responsibility for the Jewish people. That was one. Number two, they were claiming that Hashem sent them when they did not. And three, they were saying something false that Hashem never said to anybody, not to them, but Hashem didn't say at all. And there were three punishments. Who remembers the three punishments? What's that? The world will be destroyed? So you said? The wall. That's coming up. That was an analogy. But there were three actual punishments. What's that? They won't get Olam Haba. They won't get Torah. In Eretz Israel. Now they'll lose those three things. That was another three. And then Hashem says He's going to bring three types of destructive forces. And what were those? Okay. Is that what you wanted to say? The rain, the stones, and the wild wind. The stones meaning the bara, the hail from the time of Mitzvah. You have a question? You know, we really talked about it last time. I'm just reviewing this thing. Whatever, they're going to lose their they won't be able to, well, maybe we'll touch on it a little bit tonight. We'll see if we can. But we had those three. And then he said an analogy to the wall. And what were the three things that would happen to the wall? Okay, so it would be knocked down. Then it would be crumble all the way to the ground and then uprooted. Three different stages. So I was looking for a uniform theme in all the threes to line it all up. And I was not successful in being able to put it all together. But in my research, I did see some things which I thought were very noteworthy, which I'd like to share with you. First of all, in talking about the three things, destructive forces, the rain, the stones, the Ave El Gavish, those stones which are the hail, and the Ruach Sara, the terrible wind. So, one of the Mefarshim, I believe it was the Radak, hold on, let me just see if I have the right, which of the Mefarshim it was. No, it was the Marikra. The Marikra says a fascinating thing. The rain, which means a storm, the terrible rain, is represented by the armies of Nebuchadnezzar that would physically destroy the Beis HaMikdash. That's what that's referring to. This torrent of rain refers to the multitude of armies that Nebuchadnezzar was going to bring against Yerushalayim to destroy the Beis HaMikdash. That's one. The stones, the Avnei El Gavish, now what were those stones made up of? What's that?
Water and fire
together, as the bara, as the hell was in Mitzrayim. That's what it was. So, for that, he brings the pasuk in Eicha that says, "Mimarom shalach esh be'atzmosai." From the heavens, he sent a fire in my bones, which sounds like what? What would be a fire in one's bones that is sent from Shamayim? Sounds to me like a fever. Like a sickness. A pestilence. A plague. That's what it sounds like. So the Geshem Shotif, the torrent of rain, is the armies that were brought against the Mecherev, and the Avnei El Gavish, the stones, was something which was not by the hand of man, it was from Hashem, but it was Hashem inflicting a physical pain, a physical punishment, which would be a sickness of some sort. And then, Ruach Se'aros, this powerful wind. Does anybody remember? It's only been 13 chapters. Anybody remember where in Yechezkel we had a Ruach Se'ara? There was a wind that lifted him, it's true, but I don't believe it said over there Ruach Se'ara. I don't think it said a wild wind. There was a wind that lifted him up. But it could be, you're right, that a wind lifted him up. I don't remember if we used the word Se'ara over there. The hint is we had it very close to the beginning. If you look all the way back in Perek Aleph, the first chapter, in Pasuk Dalet, the fourth Pasuk, there was this wild wind that came from the north. Anybody remember what we said about that wild wind coming from the north? Well, it's true that Babel was to the north, which is where the armies would come from. But what is Yechezkel seeing? He's seeing the chariot of Hashem coming from the north with this wind. And the Gemara says, because Hashem, kiviyachol, so to speak, had to go to the north, to go to Babel, to strengthen Nebuchadnezzar, to give him the power to come and destroy the Beis HaMikdash. Actually, to give him the power to control the entire world. And that's the Ruach Se'ara, this wild wind. So the Marikra also says the wild wind over here is a reference to that wind over there in the first parak. So it seems to me the way then the three things break down is, as we said, the Geshem, the rain, represents the armies. The Avneil Gavish, the hail, represents a plague from Shamayim, from heaven. The Ruach Se'ara, it would seem, represents the spiritual realm, because that's what Yechezkel saw in the first parak. The first parak, he's seeing the Merkava, he's seeing the chariot of Hashem and everything going on with the chariot of Hashem. And as we said over and over again when we were dealing with the first parak, I think we had, I don't know, 6 or 7 classes on the first parak alone. I think so. Then we talked about how everything that Yechezkel is seeing in Shamayim is either foreshadowing what was going to happen in the future, or was a result of what had already happened on Earth. So it's foreshadowing what's going to happen, that Hashem had to go and strengthen Nebuchadnezzar to come and destroy the Beis HaMikdash. So the Ruach Se'ara is not a physical punishment. The first two are physical punishments. One is a physical punishment at the hands of man. The other is a physical punishment at the hands of God. This is a spiritual punishment, meaning that in Shamayim, in the heavens, things are happening that are not good for us, representing this wild wind that was spoken about in the first parak. That's what I think the three different punishments are that are spoken of over here. Now, this is a fascinating thing, because this explains a question which I did not articulate last time but bothered me, and now I'll share it with you, and perhaps this will answer it. In Pasuk Yud Aleph, verse 11, where it lists the three punishments, it says the rain first, the stone second, and the wind third. But in Pasuk Yud Gimel, in 13, when it's repeated, it says the wind first, the rain second, and the stones third. So the rain and the stones remain one after the other properly, but the wind, instead of being last on the list, is moved to first on the list. So it troubled me, why does it change the order? But I suspect that the answer is because, although in its direct effect on us, the most direct effect would be the armies of Nebuchadnezzar. That's what destroyed the Beis HaMikdash. And then came the pestilence, and then the Ruach Se'ara, and then the things that are happening upstairs in the heavens. But in order for the first two to happen, the third thing had to happen. Because remember, as long as Hashem's Shechina, as long as His Divine Presence was found in the Beis HaMikdash, nothing could destroy the Beis HaMikdash. It couldn't be destroyed as long as Hashem's presence was there. And so, in order for that to happen, first Hashem had to change things upstairs, and then things could happen down here. So I wonder if the reason why the order changes is, one is the order of how we feel it, the physical effects, and then the Ruach Sarah is last, but then we talk about, sequentially, the Ruach Sarah had to come first. Perhaps that would explain the change in the order. Is everybody else hot?
Which one did you
Those of you who were at the Sunday night class remember how hot it got. I figured we'll stop it now before it gets there. Okay, so that was one thing I wanted to share with you. And there was one more point I wanted to make. Let me see if I can remember what the other one was. Yes, there's a lot of things that are confusing. In order for him to be strengthened down here, first things had to be changed upstairs. Hashem has an order of things in the heavens that represent everything that goes on down here. And in order for things to change down here, he had to change things around upstairs. He's moving around the chess pieces. That's you know, he's got it all set up up there, and he moves things around as necessary.
Right.
But we were introduced to it in the first parak. That's the thing. Yechezkel told us all about what he saw, this vision of the Merkava. We talked about how this incredible vision, which we don't have virtually anywhere else in the Navi, and yet the way we're introduced to it is through a negative thing. That things are going bad, and things are being moved in order to set up a destruction. And that's when we get this incredible vision. So we spoke about that. Okay, now we will continue starting from Pasuk Yud Zayin, Pasuk verse 17. And as we said, the first 16 Psukim talked about the men, the Nevi'im, who were falsely prophesying. It seems that that was primarily, if not all, men. Even though there are women prophets as well, but it seems the false prophets were, if not all, but primarily men. But now we move into what the women were doing. Those women who were also not doing the correct thing, what were they doing wrong? And that starts on Pasuk Yud Zayin 17. V'ata ben Adam, and you son of man, sim panecha el benos amcha, put your face towards the women, the daughters of your nation, hamisnabos mi libehen, that they are prophesying from their hearts, v'hinaveh aleihen, and prophesy about them. So this is also going to be false prophets of the women, but it was going to be a little different, as we'll see. Now, let me caution you, the words in the next few psukim are very hard to translate. They're unusual words, you don't find them too often, and I'm going to translate them the way I understand them. You may have other translations in front of you, but they're not common enough to have a universal translation. V'amar Eton, you should say, K'amar Hashem Elokim, so says Hashem God, Hoy limsapros ksasos al kol atzilei yadai. Woe to those who sew, ksasos means pillows or cushions, on all arms. Atzilei yadai, there's a difference of opinion whether it means some joint in the arm. It either means the armpit or where the elbow is. Somewhere in there. But somewhere in the upper arm. Ve'osos hamispachos arosh kol kama, and they make the mispachos a mispacha would be like a tichel that goes on the head. So they make the mispachos al rosh kol koma, on the head of all those who stand, litzodeid nifashos, to hunt the souls. Ha nifashos titzodeid na leami, will you, now Hashem is directing his words to the women, will you hunt the souls to my nation? Unifashos lachena techayena, and the souls will be to you to make a livelihood off of. Meaning, these women were charging money to, in order to tell people the future, in order to tell them what happened to them, whatever the equivalent would be today. But that's what they were doing. They were doing kishuf mechashefos. We know from the Gemara, really from the Torah itself, that although kishuf, which is black magic, divination, although it is prohibited both for men and women, it seems that this was a more common sin for women to do than for men. As we know, each gender has their own challenges. It seems that this was particularly challenging for women. Women would do this more often than men. Now, it's going to be very hard for us to appreciate why, because we don't have it today. Meaning that there is such a thing as black magic. It does exist. It is real. And it has power. Hashem put this power into the world, and it does have an effect. The thing is that today nobody knows how to access it. And the reason why no one knows how to access it is because it fell by the wayside along with all other spiritual things. As we've spoken about in the past, we spoke about it with our Hanukkah shir, that when the Anshei Knesset HaGedolah took away the Yetzirah, the evil inclination, for Avodah Zarah, along with that, Nevuah was lost, and also anything in that realm. So although you may have some elements of it today, just like there is some elements of Avodah Zarah today, there is some idolatry that goes on today, but it's not so common. These things, there may be some residual effect, maybe there is something going on somewhere, but primarily anything that people do today is all fake, and they really don't have any power, and they really are simply tricking people into thinking they have power. But there is a real thing. In Mitzrayim, when we were in Egypt, enslaved in Egypt, they were experts at kishuf. Everything in Mitzrayim worked with kishuf, with magic. That's why when Moshe and Aaron came to Paro, and they did the signs, he threw the stick down, turned into a snake, he threw the water down, turned into blood, it didn't impress them. Because this is what goes on in Egypt. I mean, they were able to do that without God. They could do it with this black magic. So here, the women would do this black magic. Now this kishuf was done using two things. And Rashi tells us that we don't really know what they did, because we're not familiar with the process. But Rashi tells us that there were two things they did. The pasuk says that there were two things. There was this cushion that was sewed and put on the arm, and there was this tichel that was made and put on the head. Those are the two things that were done. The Radak has two explanations whether it was put on the arm and head of the person about whom they were doing their divination, about whom they were speaking, or is it on the arm and head of the woman who was doing the kishuf, the black magic. So there's two opinions about that. And through these mediums, they would enact their kishuf, however they did it. Rashi says we don't really know the process, but however they did it. And this would hunt the people. We'll explain that a little bit more as we go along. So Hashem is saying to Yechezkel, speak about them and say to them, do you think you'll be able to hunt these people and make a living off of their souls? Because they would charge money. You would come to them and they would charge money for their services to be able to tell you the future. Pasuk Yud Tes, verse 19. Vatichalelna osi el ami, and you profaned me to my nation, Hashem says, you profaned my name to my nation, b'sha'alei se'orim, with a sha'al. A sha'al is a measure, it's a measure of a volume. B'sha'alei se'orim, with let's say a cup, with cups of barley, u'bivsosei lechem, and with pieces of bread, which is, the simple meaning is, that's how you would pay them. A person would go to them for their for telling them the future, for their, for what do you call it, for their telling you what goes on in, what do they call it today? Fortune tellers, right? So it's to go to the fortune teller, so then it would cost the person either a cup of barley or a piece of bread. Lehamis nefashos, to put to death souls, ashelos simusena, that are not supposed to die. Ulechayos nefashos, and to give life to souls, ashelos sechayena, that are not supposed to live. Bechazevchem leami shom echazav. When you make falsehood from my nation, those who listen to falsehood, the nation is listening to falsehood, as you, the fortune tellers, you, mechashefos, you make falsehoods for my nation, and they are listening to falsehoods. So what they would say is, the people who are supposed to die, to live, they would say they're going to die. People who are supposed to die, they would say they're going to live. And as the Mefarshim fill in over here, essentially, those, it's usur, it's prohibited to go to do mechashefos. So you're not allowed to do this. So who would go to these fortune tellers? The people who were sinners. They would go and they would pay them. So because the sinners would pay them, then they would therefore say that they're going to live, when really the sinners were supposed to die. And those, the tzaddikim, the righteous ones, who wouldn't come to these women, so the women would be upset with them because they weren't getting any money from them, so they would prophesy that they're going to die, even though the tzaddikim were really supposed to live. So they would reverse what was supposed to happen. Lachain ko'amar Hashem Elokim, therefore so says Hashem God. Hinani el kisis soseichem, el kisis soseichena, I am against your cushions, that's on the arm. Asheratena mitzodidos sham es hanefashos leforchos, that you hunt there the souls to, leforchos means to fly. As Rashi explains over here, that it means to make them fly to Gehenna, to make them go, and you're gonna hurt them, but you're hurting them, making them fly to Gehenna. How is it making them end up in Gehenna? I'll explain in a moment. The Karatio Sam Elzro Sechem, I will tear them from on your arms. Vishilachni esanifashos asheratem mitzodros es nifashim leforchos. And I will send away, which means I'll save the souls that you are hunting them to send them off to fly to Gehenna. The Karatias Mispechos Sechem, and I will tear off those tichels, your tichels. It doesn't mean the head covering of a woman. Here it means the tichels that they're using for this evil. And I will save my nation from your hands. They will no longer be in your hands to be hunted, to be trapped. You will know that I am God. Yan hachos lev tzadik sheker, because you have discouraged the heart of tzadikim with falsehood. And I did not discourage him. And you have strengthened the hand of the evil people, that he should not return from his evil ways, that he should live. And you made him live. This is the main verse, Pasuk Chafez. We'll come back to it. Let's just finish the last one. Therefore, shav lo sechezena v'kesem lo siksamna. Therefore, you will not be able to do these falsehoods anymore. I will save a nation from your hands. You will know that I am God. What were they doing? They were saying, as we mentioned, they were saying to the tzaddikim that you're going to die, and they were saying to the rishayim that you're going to live. Now, it seems to me from the Mefarshim, from the commentaries, that the words that they were saying were not necessarily true. They were saying things, but they weren't going to happen. They were saying that so-and-so is going to die, when really so-and-so is going to live. Or they were saying so-and-so is going to live, when really so-and-so is going to die. The people very much believed what these women were saying. Even the tzaddikim who didn't go to these women, but they were scared of these women. And so their words carried a lot of weight. And as a result, when they announced that a particular tzaddik was going to die, that tzaddik was very discouraged. He was scared. And when they announced that a particular rasha was going to live, that rasha became very emboldened, and he became very encouraged. It seems to me from the psukim, even though the mefarshim don't say this explicitly, that it's beyond that. It's not just that their words were taken very seriously, and therefore they managed to create an atmosphere where the tzaddikim thought they were going to die and the rishayim thought they were going to live, but even more so, they actually caused some of the tzaddikim to die and some of the rishon to live, because we know that mechashefos, this sorcery, does have power. The Gemara talks about how to protect oneself from kishuf, from sorcery. And there seems to be some reality to it that it can really kill somebody or hurt somebody badly. And so, I don't know if this is only meant to be that they were causing people to think things, or if they actually were hurting people and saving people. Either way, they were going against what Hashem wanted. Because Hashem wanted the tzaddikim to be empowered and the rishayim to be discouraged. And instead, what they were doing was encouraging the rishayim and discouraging the tzaddikim. Yes? It seems that you were able to access these things. I don't know how difficult it was. Meaning, what you're asking is this something which you had to go to school to learn how to do? Or is this something that anybody could figure out if they tried hard enough? I don't know. It was a problem. People did it. I don't know whether you had to be an expert, you had to learn the trade. I just don't know.
People had to be susceptible to this.
It's absolutely.
It's a spiritual thing. It wasn't that God... It makes it almost feel like God is secondary power here.
Right.
So, He's the power. It's just that somehow these people lost their...
Well, Hashem put this power into the world. It's no different than putting the power of a physical power into the world. He put the power of electricity into the world. Now you can use electricity for good or for bad. Right? He put this thing into the world. He put a mitzvah in the Torah that you're not allowed to do it. Even though it exists, it's there. Just like Hashem created pork, you're not allowed to eat it. That's only Jews. But there are things that nobody's allowed to do. Even though Hashem created it, there are certain relationships nobody's allowed to have. But Hashem created it. It's physically possible to do, but it's still prohibited. Even for non-Jews. So Hashem created this power. It is a pseudo-spiritual power. It's not a physical thing. It's somehow, you know, it's more metaphysical than physical. And Hashem said in the Torah, you're not allowed to do it. It's usur. But people did it. In a society, in an age when spirituality was much more powerful, and people were much more in tune with spirituality, then the negative spiritual things were also more enticing, and people did them. Like idolatry. And this is another spin-off of that sort of thing.
Do they get together as a group and say this one will live and that one will die?
From the Gemara, the different Gemaras that talk about Kishuf, it seems that there were groups and there were individuals. I'm not talking about in Yecheskel, but in the Gemara it seems like that there were women who individually did Kishuf.
This isn't the first time that this is known?
No, I mean, it's a pasuk in the Torah already. The Torah says you're not allowed, you have to put to death a mechashefa, a woman who does this. A man also, but typically it was a woman. It receives the death penalty. Now, the result of what they did, of what these women were doing, was that people... It became unpopular to be a tzaddik, to be righteous, and it became popular to be a rasha. You see, what Hashem is blaming them for is if you would have left well enough alone, then the tzaddikim would feel emboldened and empowered, and that would make people want to be tzaddikim, and the rishayim would be, first of all, they'd be afraid of punishment, and they actually may have been punished. They may have started to die or been hurt. And that may have caused them to do teshuvah. So by making the rishayim, by taking away the hardships from the rishayim and making them more empowered and more emboldened, then they wouldn't do teshuvah. Why should a rasha do teshuvah if everything's going well? Why should he? He likes what he's doing, and there's nothing to force him to re-examine his ways. And the tzaddik, you're certainly going to discourage tzaddikim from being tzaddikim if things are going bad. The question that people ask today of tzaddik v'ralo and rasha v'tovlo, of why is there suffering for the righteous and why is there success for those who are evil, they were creating the suffering of the righteous and the success of the evil people. I don't want to get into a whole discussion about the suffering of the righteous and the success of the evil people for tonight, because that will get us way off topic. But we have to digress just for a moment and mention what it's about. You see, without explaining why Hashem does it, there is no question that in a perfect world, in a utopian world, in a world where Hashem's Shechina, Hashem's divine presence, is obvious to all, in such a world, tzaddikim never suffer, and rishayim never prosper. In such a world, where Hashem's divine presence is obvious and clear to all, then the world runs the way we would expect it to run according to Hashem's rules, which is that those, if you do the right thing, you have a good life, and if you do the wrong thing, you have a lousy life. That's the way the world is meant to work. As Hashem's presence becomes more and more and more obscure with galus, with exile, then things happen that don't make sense to us. Now we know that ultimately they do make sense, but we don't understand it, and we're not meant to understand it. There are certain things that we just can't understand until Mashiach comes, and we won't understand until Mashiach comes. How the Holocaust could be good is something which we can't understand. We know that intellectually everything is good, but we can't possibly understand it. Not now. When Mashiach comes, we'll know. But now we can't. It's impossible. The more obscure Hashem is, then the more the world seems to be running in ways that are contrary to Hashem. And so you see the righteous suffering. You see the wicked prospering. You say, what's going on over here? It's not the way Hashem, it's not the way it's supposed to be. And he calls into question whether there is a God. Because that's the point. As Hashem is less and less visible, whether he exists or not becomes more and more of a question. And it becomes harder and harder to believe. That's all a function of Hester Panim, of Hashem not being visible. But they existed when Hashem's presence was still more accessible. Because the Beis HaMikdash still existed. Even though it was at the tail end of the Beis HaMikdash, it was almost destroyed, it was within the 5 years before it was destroyed, and then there's no question that things had already deteriorated dramatically from where they had been in the time of David HaMelech and Shlomo HaMelech, no question about it, but you can't begin to compare the accessibility that they had to Hashem to what we have. The lack of accessibility that we have is so much less, and we have so much less of an accessibility to Hashem than they had. They were much, much closer to Hashem than we are. You can't begin to compare. As long as you have the Beis HaMikdash physically standing, it's much easier to get in touch with God. So they were living at a time when it wasn't so obscure to see God's presence. And they were causing an obscurity. They were setting in motion the process that for us makes us have questions. They were making the righteous suffer and the wicked prosper. That's what they were doing. And that makes it harder to be righteous, and for the wicked it gives them no reason to do teshuva. Yes?
It's hard for me to understand that even in these times, how, women that are doing sorcery, like even this time, you could affect a rabbi, a well-known rabbi in Israel,
you think today?
Even today, when we're so far away, I'm thinking in those times, how could these women affect these men that were even so close to Hashem? I think it's hard to imagine that women doing this stuff with.
Could somebody, God forbid, harm righteous people today? Can they blow up a bus, God forbid, and hurt people? Like, they can do it. We hope that God protects us. And usually He does. But it can happen, God forbid. Or I should say, it has happened. Right? So this was just another power that was in the world. Just like a bomb is today, a destructive force. There was a destructive force, a more spiritual destructive force, but it did exist. And one could try to use it against the righteous. You're right that if this righteous person was so righteous that Hashem would intervene, then nothing could hurt him or her. But if the person was righteous but not super righteous, he could get hurt. And it did happen.
What's the woman have fought at this? You have to correct me, but women are born without a correction. So, as I hear it, we are close to Hashem without a correction of some sort. I don't believe like that. But would it be because of their going through spiritual insight to Hashem? And that's why they pick up more of what is not right in the world. That's why the women initiated this over the men.
You're trying to explain why women are more susceptible to kishuf, to this black magic, than men are.
Even today, because we have this close connection, and we talk to Hashem all day long.
Right. I don't know. It could be you're right. It's certainly going to be gender specific. It's going to have something to do with the innate makeup of a woman versus the innate makeup of a man. There's no question. But what it is, I don't know. You see, let's just contrast one other thing. The men who were accused of being false prophets, they were accused of doing what? Of telling the people, don't worry, the Beis HaMikdash won't be destroyed, things will be okay, there won't be a destructive force coming, there won't be an army that will come and attack. Don't believe what Yechezkel says, don't believe what Yirmiyahu says. That's what the false male prophets were saying. The false female prophets weren't dealing on a national scale. They were dealing with individuals. Ooh, you're going to have a long life. That person is going to die. They were being very specific. It was a different way. It was the same type of sin, but it was a different way of focusing the sin. The men were focused on the national scene. The women were focused on individuals. Both of them were evil. So that also has to do with men and women. And we could sit here and try to explain the gender specific ways of acting evil, which is what was going on over here. But the men were more concerned with the national scene, and the women were more concerned with the individuals, I guess, around them.
Yeah. Well, we were talking last week about the motivation the men had. What would be the motivation here?
Okay.
They're getting monetary gain.
Yeah. So it seems, well. See, here's the difference. The difference is, see, Mrs. Katz is asking a good question. That the men, we said before, were very close to being very righteous, because they were false prophets. Well, they knew what a prophet was. So if you're a false prophet, then you must be able to be confused with a real prophet. Here, that's not the case. See, here they were doing kishuf. Kishuf could be done by anybody. And so, although you're right that in Pasuk Yud Zayin in 17 it does say Hamis Nabos, they are prophesying. So I don't know. Let's think about that for a moment. I didn't think along those lines. So you're bringing up a good point. We said last week that the men had to have some motivation that was sort of good. Even though it was bad, they definitely sinned. But because we're talking about pretty righteous people, or almost Nevi'im, or they were at one time Nevi'im, then they must have had a good motivation. At least they thought they had a good motivation in what they did. What would be the motivation over here? The only thing the Navi says is they were getting money for it. I think that's a fair question. I don't have a ready answer for it. Yeah. Excellent. Okay, that's where we're going. Perfect. Okay. So, Mrs. Lewis hit the jackpot. The two things that were done, one was on the arm and one was on the head. Now, women don't wear tefillin, but there is this power that the tefillin does represent. The tefillin, which are placed on the arm and on the head, represent a specific type of koach, of strength, spiritual strength. So what is that spiritual strength? What does the head tefillin represent and what does the arm tefillin represent? Okay, so one, the head tefillin represents being meshabed, making meshabed your mayach, making your intellect subservient to God. And the arm tefillin, which is across from the heart, represents making one's desires subservient to God. The arm would be because the hands are the way one carries out their desires. But it's across from the heart. And so it's the desires, the lave, and the intellect, the moach. And they are made subservient to God by putting on tefillin. The Gemara tells us a striking thing, that God Himself wears tefillin. And you're familiar with that. Now we don't know what that means, because God doesn't have a body. He doesn't have a head. He doesn't have an arm. He certainly can't wear anything. So Clearly, Chazal, our sages, are using the terminology in a way that we can understand it, but it obviously doesn't mean he wears tefillin. It says that when Moshe wanted to see Hashem, and Hashem told him, you can't see me, but you can see my back. I'll cover you up, and then after I pass by, you'll look and you'll see my back. So the Gemara says, what did he see? What did Moshe see? What did Hashem let him see? He saw the knot of the tefillin, which is in the back of the head. So that's it's a very mystical Gemara, what that means exactly. But you see that tefillin is a very powerful mitzvah. There's a lot going on with tefillin. If Hashem wears tefillin, and that's what Moshe saw about Hashem, that's what he revealed to him, clearly tefillin is a very, very powerful thing, whatever it is. Moreover, just to bring out this point of how powerful tefillin is, really, we're supposed to wear tefillin all day. Really, a man is supposed to wear tefillin from morning until night. From the time it gets light until it gets dark, he takes them off before it gets dark. That's what he's supposed to do every day. Just like you wear tzitzis, a man wears tzitzis all day long, he's supposed to wear tefillin all day long. But we only wear it in the morning for shacharis. And the reason is because in order to wear tefillin properly, one must make sure that while they are wearing tefillin, they maintain a physically clean body, A, and B, a spiritually clean mind, all the time. If one's thoughts are impure while wearing tefillin, that is a pagam, that is a blemish on the mitzvah of tefillin itself. And so, therefore, because not just today, but already going back for several hundred years, we do not trust ourselves to be able to maintain that lofty level of spirituality while wearing our tefillin. Therefore, the minhag, the custom, is to only wear tefillin in the morning. But just to show the power of the tefillin, if the tefillin demands such perfection from the human being, we have to act almost as if we're angels while wearing the tefillin. And so, if that's what the tefillin demands in order to perform the mitzvah, you see that there's obviously something very powerful about it. These women were tapping in to that spiritual power and they were mutilating it. They were using it in their way for negative, for kishuf. Question?
The wearing of tefillin came about after we received the tzaddah.
Well, the Gemara tells us that already Abraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov kept the whole Torah. So they kept it before it was commanded. But you're right, the commandment came with the Torah at Har Sinai.
Did Abraham wear
it? It seems that way because they kept the whole Torah.
All day long?
I would imagine. Abraham certainly was on the level to do it. You know, he was spiritually on that level.
And when did it stop? I mean, did men carry that for years?
To wear it all day long?
Yeah,
they went on. They wore it all day long in the time of the Gemara, and then sometime after the Gemara, they stopped doing it. I don't know when they stopped doing it. There were individuals. The Vilna Gaon wore tefillin all day long. There were individuals who were still able to do it. No, Rabbi Shimon doesn't wear tefillin all day long. I don't believe so. See, Rabbi Shimon does wear the tefillin for a long time. He wears it after davening. He learns after davening, and he wears it for a long time after davening. I don't believe that he wears it all day long. I don't believe so. Could be I'm wrong, but I don't think so. And for Moshe, I don't know that he wore it all day long.
Like, if they did wear it, or unless they maybe they could on, is it like one day you would have this feeling that you can wear it all day?
Well, it's the same.
They don't quite feel up there, or like how?
I think they would have to reach a point where they can trust themselves that they know that there's no.
Like a daily occurrence.
Yeah.
This sounds like a feminist thing.
Which?
The women with the cushion and the
veil. They were the
tefillin.
What's that?
And that's how they were being powerful. That was their motivation.
To get a hold of this mitzvah of tefillin.
Right, and so, right. That was their motivation because that's why women did it, not men. This was their way of having.
That's interesting. I don't know. I also don't know if this is the only way to do kishuf, if this is the only way to do this sorcery. The Torah doesn't say how it's done. Her just says, Mechashefa lo sechaya, a sorceress, do not leave alive. That's what the Torah says, which means you have to kill her. But I don't know how you do it, and I don't know if this is the only way to do it. So this is clearly one method. Maybe it has to do with trying to get a hold of that mitzvah. I don't know. They could have put on tefillin if they wanted to get a hold of the mitzvah. I'm saying it wasn't like they couldn't find a pair of tefillin. But
they just Why couldn't we just say positive is parallel to that?
Right. Right.
So that, I don't know what it would be.
Did they think they were doing something positive?
So that's really...
Maybe with their visa and this?
That's what Mrs. Kessler is asking. I don't know. It's a fair question, because that's what we said is true with the men, so I don't know if that's what happened over here with the women. I don't know.
But Hashem created Kessler that people are visiting. I don't think it's positive at all. I think it's all the whole thing with... They're going to provoke the people not to listen to
Hashem. I'm sorry. Schwartz. Can you all really give me a question? I'm sorry. Yes. Go ahead.
That's my business.
Yeah. I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I think it's all the thing that Hashem saw the Chassid in the beginning of Sefer, so the people are missing him. So women were doing it, I think, to get the power of Tefillah, you know, using it to divert us into the counterpart where the male in the rule was coming out. You know, don't listen to your Chassid, everything will be okay. So they're also
to drawing
everything. They were wicked. They
don't want to control. It's true. But we just last week we tried to explain that it was more of a subtle type of thing, because they thought it was better for the people. That it'll be better for them if they're given a little more confidence. Here it's hard to justify to tell the wicked that they're going to be okay and the righteous they're not going to be okay. It's hard to justify.
Does this barley honey meet bread and meat Canadian meat to the barley that Ruth brought to them?
Okay, that's a good guess. I am about to get to the barley. That's what we're going to talk about. That's the last point we're going to make. Yeah. Only because it parallels the men. That's all. The men had to have been good because they were false prophets. They were. With the women, we don't know, except that since it's parallel in the same parak, it would seem that just what the men were doing in there. It says Hamis Nabos in Pasuk Gezayin. It sounds like, right. Except they're not called Nevios Shakranos, whatever the word would be. With the men, they're called Nevi'e Sheker.
Right, but they have to, just to get a Nevuah, they have to be in a high level.
Right. But with the men, both the men and the women were not getting a Nevuah. They were faking it. But with the men, people thought that they were Nevi'im. I don't know if over here they thought the women were Nevi'os or not. That's what I'm saying. I'm not sure. Because if it's Kishuv, I don't know. You know, Kishuv is Kishuv. I don't know if they thought that they were Nevi'os. So I just want to make this last point, which is I'm glad you brought us back to this. In Pasuk Yud Tes, in 19, it says that how do they pay them? B'shalei sorim uvivsosei lechem. With this measure of barley and with these pieces of bread. So to me, when I was preparing for tonight's shiur, it struck me... What's that? Okay, the karbonos is true. That's true. That's not what struck me, but that is true. There is a correlation here to karbonos. How would you make it correlate to karbonos?
Because the barley.
Because
the barley.
Okay, the barley. And how about the bread? Okay. The word pisuse lechem, the word psuse or pasos is used with the menachos, used with the flour offerings in the Beis HaMikdash. The ones that were baked, you know, most of the flour offerings in the Beis HaMikdash, almost all of them, so what you had to do is you brought flour to the Beis HaMikdash. There was a certain part that was taken off by the Kohen, the kmitza that was taken off by the Kohen, that was burned, and the rest was eaten by the Kohanim. Some of them, the kmitza was taken off before it was baked. Others, the kmitza was taken off after it was baked. So how do you take it off after it was baked? You can't take a handful of flour after it's baked. After it's baked, it's bread. So you'd have to break it up into pieces. The Torah calls that pasos. Pasos osa pitim. Break it into pieces, and then a piece is taken, or some of the pieces are taken for the kmitza, to go to the mizbeach. So it's striking that same word is used, pisuse lechem. Shale seorim. Seorim, barley, is also used in karbonos, but only in two of the karbonos to use barley. It always has to be wheat, except for two karbonos, and they are? Not Shavuos. Shavuos was wheat. But you're close. Pesach, the Omer. The Omer had to be barley, and there's another one that's always barley. What's that? Sota. Sota, for the woman who's accused of being adulterous, so she, the carbon she had to bring was barley, and that was degrading. That was because she acted like an animal, therefore her carbon had to be one that was animal food. Barley being inferior to wheat, therefore it is considered in the Torah to be more akin to animal food than people food. So here it seems that the analogy is from one extreme to the other. From the lowest level of carbon mincha, of flour offering, which involved barley, to the most refined, which was bread, maybe the lechem hapanim, or the shtei halechem of Shavuos. That's what it seems that this corresponds to. But what struck me is that this word, b'shalei se'orim, b'shalei, which means in the cup, or the measures of barley, is very, very similar to a word we had earlier in this same parak, in the same chapter last week, which means something different. Look back in Pasuk Dalet, verse 4. Verse 4. First word. Pasuk Dalet. Kishualim, foxes. I never thought of this before. The word for fox, which is shu'al, and the word for this type of measure, which is sha'al or shal, are spelled exactly the same way. A little bit different vowelization, but they're spelled exactly the same way. One means a fox, and one means a measure. So I don't know what the connection between those two things is usually, but in this parak, it's easy for us to make a clear connection. What did we say last week about these shu'alim, these foxes? They what? Right. They stand in the opening, but then as soon as someone comes, they go away. So they appear as if they're there to protect the people, but then when they don't stand up, whenever there's a danger, they run away. Whenever there's danger, and that was one of the things that the Nevi'ei Sheker were being blamed for. That here a Navi is supposed to stand up for the people, stand in the breach to block the enemy, and instead you're acting like a fox that as soon as you see danger, you turn around and run. Here, it seems that a similar thing is being mentioned. B'sha'alei se'orim, they were being paid with sha'alei se'orim u'b'psosei lechem, with these measures of barley. But the word is the same as shu'al, as fox. That it acts as the same way. Where the barley and the bread should have been brought where? To the Beis HaMikdash. And instead, just as they were, what's the right word? With the mitzvah of tefillin. They were taking the mitzvah of tefillin and they were controverting it. Okay, good. There's the other words too. So it seems that the same thing was going on with the flour and with the different types of grain, where it should have been brought to the Beis HaMikdash, and these women were having it brought to them in order to perform this kishuf. And so, just as with the analogy to the foxes, where it's meant to be one thing, it's meant to stand in the air, like with the Nevi'im, they were supposed to stand there and stop the enemy, and instead they are acting like foxes to run away. It appears one way and then it comes out something else. Here also, these women were doing something, they were tapping in to powerful forces, that of tefillin, that of karbonos. These were powerful forces, but they were using them in a way that was evil for kishuf. And that's why Hashem says that they will not survive. Hashem will punish them for the way that they have acted. And that brings us to the end of Perek Yud Gimel. The schedule of the former mentioned at the end of his class is that the next 2 weeks there will not be classes. And then, starting on January 9th, I believe, we will continue the Cheskel as usual, Perek Yud Daled. That'll be at 8:30, as we've been doing it. At 7:30, Rabbi Freundlich's class will be taught by Rabbi Stein for 3 weeks. He will be giving a refresher. Do you know what specifically part of Kashrus is going to do? I don't know. Something in Kashrus. Whatever it's going to be. I encourage you all to attend Rabbi Stein's classes. I have to tell you that I'm going to shut off the tape for this, but Kashrus in the kitchen. I have to tell